What's up, little psychos? I'm Investigator Slater, host of the Psychopedia podcast. Psychopedia is a true crime podcast delivering raw, real, and absolutely gripping episodes every single week. I dig deep to uncover fascinating details of heinous true crime cases while exploring criminology and psychology theories. I take you into the absolute darkest corners of the human psyche, my favorite territory, and present cases like you've never heard them before. Follow and listen to Psychopedia everywhere you get your podcasts.
He hates the Chiefs.
The first time ever, Mahomes goes 9-8.
He's delusional about his Bengals.
Joe Burrow's going to get the job done again because he's going to be healthy. And they're going to win, and they're going to go to New Orleans and be in the Super Bowl.
But he knows everything about college football. Here's the host of the 249 Miles of College Football podcast, Drew Nixon.
Well, while the rest of us here in Chiefs Kingdom are probably celebrating after the events of yesterday afternoon and evening, Drew, I imagine you're struggling a little bit. You know, what is your reaction to the Chiefs taking down the Houston Texans yesterday, 23-14?
I think it was a really good win. I did pick the Chiefs. I've picked the Chiefs in all but, I think, two games this year. So people have to give me a hard time, but I do have a respect for the Chiefs. It is a little frustrating, though, because I think that matchup yesterday, it should have been the Bengals, and they're playing the Chiefs instead in the divisional round, but hey, it didn't happen. It's all good.
Yeah, just curious, you know, I mean, we've been talking a lot this morning. It's been all over social media, right? You've got 31 fan bases complaining about, you know, two controversial calls, the roughing the passer and the unnecessary roughness on Mahomes, and oh, the refs were in the Chiefs' pocket and this and that and the other. Not a lot of mention from the other fan bases about the 8 sacks, the botched fourth down, the two missed kicks, and the blocked field goal. What do you make of that? And what do you make of, like, D'Amico Ryan's and Will Anderson's post-game comments saying that, you know, they had to play against the refs as well as they did the Chiefs?
Yeah, that's a little bit of loser mentality. Like, even when the Bengals have had problems and they've complained, it's very frustrating to hear, you know, the referee talk, because to your point, Logan, it's very hard to overcome 8 sacks and win a playoff game. Although CJ Stroud battled and played really well, played about as good as he can. It seemed like for about 3 quarters, Houston played the better game, but Kansas City was still leading, like, at halftime. So I thought the Chiefs should have felt great at halftime, given the position that they were in, because it felt like they hadn't quite hit their stride yet. But defensively, the most impressive thing, I think, for the Chiefs was George Karlaftis having the day that he did. What a big moment for him. And, yeah, everybody loves to complain about the Chiefs, and I don't like doing the whole ref thing, because some of it might be valid, I guess, in terms of the flopping and stuff like that. But, hey, Josh Allen's been doing that for a couple years now, and all of a sudden it's a problem now. Kind of interesting, I guess.
Yeah. And then the flop that everybody, you know, that a lot of the Twitterverse or whatever, which, you know, Twitter can be great, it can also be an absolute cesspool, was complaining about there on the end of the side. He didn't even get the call there, right? It's not like he generated a 15-yarder for that, for the flopping that, so, you know, that definitely occurred. I'm not going to say it allegedly. He flopped for sure. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. You know, curious, now that the Chiefs are in the AFC Championship game for the 7th straight year, you look at that other divisional round game, Bills versus Ravens, before we get into some college football talk here with you. What do you make of that matchup tonight? Who do you think the Chiefs meet next week at Arrowhead for a trip to the Super Bowl?
So I'm leaning towards the Ravens, and the reason why, I think, is just when you look at what Baltimore has done defensively, and I know that they haven't played as good of opponents, which is probably part of why they've been so good in this area. But it was mentioned, I think, last week when the Ravens played the Pittsburgh Steelers, is that they moved Kyle Hamilton up to high safety. And since that move, they jumped from, like, the mid to high 20s in passing rankings and passing efficiency to first in the NFL in that time frame. So I think that adjustment's really been able to help them out. And they, to me, are maybe the more dangerous team just in terms of what they've been able to do against the pass compared to what Buffalo would do. If I was a Chiefs fan, I maybe actually would want Buffalo maybe to win this game, I think, because I think the Chiefs can take advantage, and given that they played them more recently, make some adjustments there. But I think Baltimore's going to end up winning the game. I think Derrick Henry might end up being a little bit too much for Buffalo today.
Going to be a fun one to watch, no doubt about it. And we anxiously await to see who the Chiefs are going to be heading up against next week at Arrowhead for that trip to New Orleans. But We do have a massive game tomorrow. A champion will be crowned, the College Football Playoff National Championship. The first year of this 12-team format, and it's two teams who did not win their conferences, one that's not even in a conference, two teams that did not receive first-round byes, the seventh seed in Ohio State against the eighth seed in Notre Dame. Who's going to win this national championship game? Everybody wants to know, but I'm just curious to get your thoughts on how this format has worked in your view. This 12-team field, right? You got the top four seeds, conference, you know, power conference champions. Boise State gets a bye. You've got Arizona State with a bye, and then you've got, of course, Oregon and Georgia. Do you like the way that this field has played out with 12 teams? Do you think it's too many? Do you think that they should expand it even further? Just curious to hear what you think.
So from the jump, I always thought that 8 was the play at first. Like, go to 8, and then you can expand even further if you want to. Obviously, we're not going to go back from 12 to 8 because that's just not how things work with these kinds of things and money. I think that 12 has been fine. I get why people have been complaining about the blowouts and stuff like that. But college football, that's part of its DNA in a way, where when you get teams that are matched up against each other that are at their peak unequal, or even if they are a little bit equal at their peak, if one or two matchup things go one team's way, the game can get out of hand, i.e. Tennessee and Ohio State, two really good defenses, but one offense played significantly better than the other and one defense struggled, and the game was a blowout. I think that it's been good for college football in general, just because the national audience has grown. People are paying more attention to college football, it seems like, than they ever have from a casual fan angle, which is good, even though I'm a diehard, and there are others who are complete diehards who feel about it, and it's fine. The national scope on the entire playoff is there because there's more teams involved. People like that. The idea that everybody gets a shot, including the little guy like Boise State. I think it's been a success. I do think they're going to expand at some point. They're already talking about it, as a matter of fact. There's some things that need to be tweaked, like seeding, and I also would love, and they're actually going to be talking about this, I think, for 2026 or maybe beyond, the quarterfinal games hosting on campus. That would be really exciting to me because I think if you do get a bye, you deserve to host a playoff game.
I agree. I love the way that that would shape up if it were the way that it ultimately plays out. But you look at these two teams, Notre Dame against Ohio State, and I find it fascinating, right? When you looked at the semifinal matchups, we live in an era where, I believe that college football and professional football are different in some respects. Everybody is kind of the opinion nowadays where it's offense, offense, offense all the time. You got to score points. Offense wins you games. Offense does this. This is a matchup between two of the five best defenses in college football, right? All four of these teams, whether it's Texas and Penn State as well in the semifinal rounds, all four of which were top 10 defenses in the league. So sort of adding on to that adage of offense wins games, defense wins championships, what do you make of these two defenses going into this game Monday night? What are going to be the keys to success for the Irish and the Buckeyes on that side of the football to try to give themselves an opportunity to win?
Yeah, I think I'll start off with Ohio State, then I'll go to Notre Dame. So defensively for Ohio State, you know, you got JT Tuimoloau, you've got Caleb Downs, you've got some really good defensive players. Jack Sawyer, of course, who's had a ridiculously good college football playoff and season. Containing Riley Leonard, I think, is going to be important for them. One of the things that Notre Dame did particularly well against Penn State, if you look at moving the ball around, they used the running backs in the passing game. One of the things that Ohio State had a little bit of a difficult time with, in particular with Jaden Blue and also Quintrevion Weisner, is they allowed them in the passing game to do some damage. So if you look at Notre Dame and what they do effectively, Aeneas Williams is utilized and also Jeremiah Love in the passing game. Containing them, because the wide receivers aren't as talented, obviously, for Notre Dame as Ohio State, but they move the ball around a little bit more. And Riley Leonard, just keeping contain on him because he's able to use his legs, he's able to make big plays. If you can put pressure on him and allow him to stay to keep him inside the pocket, we've seen him make turnovers and commit turnovers and make mistakes. So that might be some of the game plan going forward. They've got a really good pass rush, so I would expect them to put some pressure on Riley Leonard. On the flip side, Texas went all in on stopping Jeremiah Smith. They did a really good job of it. They still lost the game because Carnell Tate had a great day. Emeka Egbuka had a really good day. And Travion Henderson kind of went off. if Notre Dame can eliminate the run game or really limit it with Travion Henderson and Quinshon Judkins, then you're making Will Howard make all the plays. And we've seen him make a couple mistakes as well throughout the college football playoff. I do wonder that if they can stop the run game, do they go all in on stopping Jeremiah Smith, or do they trust their guys man-to-man? Al Golden said that they're going to go man-to-man. He thinks that Christian Gray, who's one of the best corners in all of college football, and then Jordan Clark and the nickel, they've also got Xavier Watts at free safety. They've got a secondary that's good enough to hang on or to hang in with those guys who are elite for Ohio State. So I just feel like the game's going to be really good, because I think your point is right. Everybody loves offense, but this could be another one of those defensive games where maybe things break out a little bit in the second half, but it could be lower scoring going into halftime because these defenses are so good at what they do.
And you mentioned some of the offense there, right? Riley Leonard for Notre Dame, that two-headed running back attack they've got with Anais Williams and you know, the other back for Notre Dame. I blank on his name at the moment. And then Ohio State, you know, that offense is loaded for bear. The two running backs with Judkins and Quinshon, you know, and Henderson, Travion Henderson, and then the receivers with Emeka Abuka and Jeremiah Smith. It seems like on paper, right, the Buckeyes have the advantage because they got a more, you know, a more name notable sort of offense. What does Notre Dame need to do offensively to be successful? Is it, you know, using Riley Leonard with his legs? Is it relying on the running backs? Is it trying to get the tight ends a little bit more involved? What do the Irish have to do to keep pace?
I think some of it goes into all of what you said, but also I think they need to just stay ahead of the sticks. If they're in a situation where Riley Leonard, he's likely not going to use his legs to get a first down, but he has to make a big-time throw. He's capable, but I think you're going to live with it a little bit more if you're Ohio State and it's a 3rd and 8, 3rd and 9, instead of it being like a 3rd and 3, 3rd and 4 situation. If Notre Dame can stay ahead of the sticks and try to get it to those 3rd and short, 3rd and mid situations, it bodes well for them. And for Ohio State, being able to be in that spot defensively can really help them. For Ohio State, I think it's, in terms of like a key for them offensively, if they can get the run game going, it'll open everything up for them, because we know how good Jeremiah Smith is, where it doesn't matter if he's covered or even double teamed at this rate. If they throw the ball up to him, he's able to make a play. But teams have been doing good enough on him where other guys are getting open and they don't even have to throw the ball to Jeremiah Smith. The fact that Notre Dame is likely going to go man-to-man, it sounds like, I feel like there's going to be some opportunities for Jeremiah Smith, and Will Howard's got to connect on those, because obviously when you have a talent like Jeremiah Smith, you got to get him the ball, and it's only going to help Notre Dame. They're only going to help Ohio State's chances of putting some points on the board.
So if it is Ohio State that ultimately wins this national championship, which I am of the belief they will, what does this mean for a head coach in Ryan Day, who, you know, comes into Columbus and has to fill the shoes of Urban Meyer, a guy who won a college football playoff national championship for the Buckeyes and has been under so much scrutiny and such a massive magnifying glass? And, you know, people are talking about after the Michigan game, is Ryan Day going to get fired? And all they've done is make it all the way to the college football playoff national championship game. What is that going to do for him and for this Buckeyes team moving forward to finally have that mark against them scratched clean?
Yeah, I talked about this a little bit on the 249 Miles of College Football podcast. Anywhere you can download podcasts, you can go find it. There's so many storylines in this game, Logan, and one of them is what you're talking about. Ryan Day has an opportunity, which it's really weird, almost to etch his legacy, etch his name in stone at Ohio State for being I don't want to say a legend, because I don't know if that's necessarily the right word, but he's going to be in some celebratory lore because of winning a national title, which is kind of nuts considering where we were 2 or 3 weeks ago, where everybody was essentially ready to put his head on the chopping block. It is interesting. I know that the Ohio State fan base is obviously passionate and everything like that, but they were criticized by Kirk Herbstreit and everything. Like, the man is 45-8 or whatever the heck it was. Whatever his record is, it's ridiculous. It's a lot like what Jim Harbaugh had at Michigan before he finally beat Ohio State, was his record's really good. He just can't win the big game. For Ryan Day to win a national title while also never beating Michigan would be kind of crazy, and I think that people would accept it only if he won a national title. Like, him making it here doesn't mean anything to them, and as far as I'm concerned, with the fan base in terms of celebrating him as an Ohio State head coach. But if he gets it done, I think his his stature within the Ohio State fan base and alma mater group is going to be a lot more likable if they are able to pull it off.
And then on the flip side for Marcus Freeman in Notre Dame, you know, he gets the job after Brian Kelly leaves and goes to LSU. And when asked why he made the move, he said he wanted to go to a program where he had the resources to win a national championship. Hasn't gotten anywhere near it in his couple of years at LSU, and Marcus Freeman has Notre Dame 60 minutes away from their first national championship since 1991. What would a win for the Fighting Irish mean for Marcus Freeman and for Brian Kelly when he made those sort of, you know, inflammatory comments back when he took the job in Baton Rouge?
It would mean so much because obviously, you know, it is nice that we have two big brands in the national title, but Notre Dame being one of those brands and them having struggled whenever they've made a national title or been in the national conversation here as of late, it would be a massive deal. Where I think, honestly, if Marcus Freeman, if they win the title Tuesday, they should start building a statue for Marcus Freeman because it would mean that big of a deal. Not only that, but one of the other storylines is he's now become the first black coach to be in the national title game. He can be the first black coach to ever win a national title. So there's a lot that people are looking forward to the potential of regarding history, not just with Notre Dame, but with Marcus Freeman in particular. For Brian Kelly, I think it's obvious that because they have the same amount of resources. I know that NIL has helped things out, but Notre Dame's NIL situation is more unique compared to other schools across the country. Marcus Freeman being able to utilize that and get them to a national title amidst this, I think just kind of shows that he's a better coach than Brian Kelly. And then the fact, like you said, Brian Kelly hasn't sniffed the national title at LSU yet. The resources are still the same as far as I'm concerned, but Marcus Freeman's getting him there. Marcus Freeman might be one of, if not the best coach in college football right now at the moment. His players love him, and it would mean a whole lot for Notre Dame, I think, because he's made him he's made him likable, which is really weird because we're used to not liking Notre Dame at all whatsoever. And I know you and I talked about this a little bit last week, Logan, but the fact that he's made them likable as well, very, very unique situation at Notre Dame with the Marcus Freeman, and he's showing why over the course of these last couple weeks why everybody does like him so much. I think
it's certainly a weird change of heart, you know, not being absolutely against Notre Dame all the time. But final question I've got for you, Drew, is a pretty simple one. Who wins this game? You know, what is your prediction for the Buckeyes and the Fighting Irish? Who is going to hoist this college football playoff national championship trophy in the first year of the 12-team format?
So I think Ohio State is going to do just enough to win the game. I've got the Buckeyes 24-21. I'm going to stick with the whoever won the game between Oregon and Ohio State wins the whole thing. I think that this is what happens. It's going to be a good one, though. I think people can expect a really good national title game, which would be a nice culmination of how good this playoff has been.
I love it. I'm with you, Drew. I've got Ohio State winning this game. I got it up being a little bit more high scoring. I've got Buckeyes 31-24 in this game. But I agree. I think this is going to be a phenomenal matchup. I don't think it'll be one of those one-sided affairs that we grew so accustomed to with the four-team format. Really, really excited about this one. That's Drew Nixon. He is the midday producer for Cody and Gold here on 96.5 The Fan. He's also the host of the 249 Miles of College Football podcast here through Odyssey. Drew, appreciate you taking some time this morning. Have a good weekend, man.
Thanks for having me, Logan. You too.
No problem at all. That, again, that's Drew Nixon joining us, talking some college football playoff national championship game, Notre Dame Fighting Irish against the Ohio State Buckeyes tomorrow night in Atlanta. Going to be a lot of fun there. We've also got NFL divisional round games going on today. You got two of them, Rams Eagles, of course, this afternoon, Ravens Bills, which we talked about a little bit earlier in the show. Our phone number is 913-586-7965. If you want to give us a call, or you can send us a message through our text line. It's the same number, 913-586-7965. We can talk Chiefs Texans. We can talk Bills Ravens. We can talk about this national championship game that we may see tomorrow. So much to get to here for the rest of the show. We got about 40 minutes left. This is After Hours with Logan Weber and Quentin Morris on 96.5 The Fan, your home for Kansas City sports. I'm going to be honest, it's a good feeling waking up on a Sunday knowing that there's NFL football occurring. A little bit disappointing that the Chiefs aren't playing, but it's a good, disappointing considering the fact that the Chiefs have already taken care of business. They already won, right? So I don't have to worry. I can just watch football completely worry-free on this Sunday as we await who are going to be the other two opponents in the conference championship games. You've got Eagles-Rams this afternoon, Ravens-Bills at 5:30. Chiefs are just going to wait to see who their opponent is, and it's going to be an interesting one to say the least. Our number, 913-586-7965. You can give us a call or send us a message on the text line. We do have a couple of guys on the line with us right now. I want to talk a little Ravens-Bills. We've got Dan from KCK on the line with us. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, Logan, how you doing? Now I talk to you about the game. Yeah, and they said that on ESPN, Zach Flowers is out. But I think the Ravens have enough to beat the Bills with King Henry and the Rams-Eagles. All the Rams got to do is just shut down Saquon Barkley. Yeah, I think it's still going to be Chiefs and the Rams in the Super Bowl. And Ryan Clark was talking about last night with Scott Van Pelt about that unnecessary roughness, and now they're making a big deal out of it with Mahomes. So what are your thoughts about that, Logan? I think he was trying to, you know, it was close, but they have to call that, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think they have to call it in that situation. I mean, that's what the rules dictate. And for somebody like Ryan Clark, I understand his point. I understand his premise. Anybody who remembers watching Ryan Clark play in the National Football League, that dude had no regard for his safety or the safety of anybody else on the football field. He was going 100% body part to the wall, if you know what I mean, every single snap. And, you know, a lot of the helmet to helmet contact and defenseless receiver penalties and, you know, all those sorts of penalties that have now been part of the National Football League lexicon can be attributed to Ryan Clark and Troy Polamalu and those, the guys of that era, Cam Chancellor and Ed Reed and others who just decapitated dudes. I understand that you don't like the rule. That doesn't mean that the rule is incorrect or that the official made a bad call in that sense. That was, by definition, a roughing the passer penalty. That was, by definition, an unnecessary roughness. You may not like the rule, but that is the rule, and the official's job during the course of a football game is to enforce the rules that are placed upon them. Simple fact of the matter. That's just the way it goes. Appreciate the call, Dan. We've got Fred from Overland Park on the line with us now. Go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, the big joke is none of those calls had anything to do with the loss.
So exactly.
That just makes them out look clowns that have escaped from some zoo after getting circus after getting fired. I'm calling about the disrespect from the sports media. Like, and I, as I told the gentleman that answered the phone, you go to Yahoo's homepage, the sports page, all they want to say about the Chiefs is basically they keep winning even after piss poor play, etc.
Gone South has been a podcast about crime in the American South. But for our new season, we're widening the lens. Follow and listen to Gone South Season 5, wherever you get your shows.
Whatever words they used, not one of them have been a professional that have said that you've had multiple injuries, players out for as long as Hollywood Brown, Pacheco. You've had people in different positions to fill in. We've had to bring in people like Hunt, et cetera. It takes time for all of that. It takes time for those players to get back into the groove of the plays. And then you have the new pieces. So it's just the good part is the Chiefs need to, from this point on, instead of having Ric Flair come in there, we need Roger Dangerfield and say we're getting no respect. Because this time it's not a joke. We really are.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. Fred, appreciate you calling in. Yeah, I get it, right? The Chiefs are not winning pretty anymore. This is not the Legion of Zoom. This is not the Tyreek Hill, Patrick Mahomes, Travis Kelce, Sammy Watkins era of Chiefs football anymore. Because they've realized there are other ways to win football games. Back in those days of 2018, 19, 20, that's how you had to win. Because the Chiefs defense was not all that great during that time, right? You had bits and pieces, right? You had your Chris Jones and your Marcus Peters, and you had guys out there. But you had to win by putting up points. And now you've reached a stage where for Mahomes and company, it's not about numbers. It's not about points. It's not about accolades. It's about winning football games. That's it. It's about getting the W. Rather win ugly than lose pretty, right? Ask the Detroit Lions about that, right? The Lions were the media's darling all year this year. Oh my goodness, look at this offense and Ben Johnson and this and that, and he should be an NFL head coach, and oh, the trick plays, and they threw a pass to Penei Sewell and the Sonic and Knuckles thing with Jahmyr Gibbs and David Montgomery, and man, they're so much fun to watch. What did all that fun get you? A one seed and a loss in the divisional round of the playoffs. Did the Chiefs win an ugly football game yesterday? You're damn right they did. But they won, didn't they? It's all that matters. All that matters is the W. You can be as disappointed as you want. You can hope, and I know. The national media wants the 5,000-yard and 50-touchdown version of Mahomes. I understand it. We do too. We as Chiefs fans want to see that from Patrick Mahomes. But you know what we want to see more? Wins. You know what Mahomes wants to see more? Wins. And guess what? That's all he's doing is winning. Complain all you want. Talk, you know, yell at the wall. Stare into the abyss and be the old man who yells at cloud meme from The Simpsons. That's all you are right now. And guess what? We're enjoying the hell out of it. We're going to sit here and enjoy you complaining about the Chiefs not winning pretty enough for you. Because guess what? All it means is that we're still winning. Get over it. That's all I got for you. That's it. Fred's exactly right. Fred got me a little fired up with that one. I'm going to be honest. Appreciate you, Fred. We got more time for callers here. 913-586-7965. You can also send us a message on our text line here. I got a message from a 605. We got a Chiefs fan from South Dakota getting involved on the show this morning. He says he's a lifelong Chiefs fan from South Dakota. What a special time in our lives. We'll never get to experience this again as Chiefs fans. Let's enjoy every second. This is what we were dreaming about would happen someday. Yeah, and he's right. I mean, like I said at the start of the show, when I was growing up, right, I got to see sort of the bookend of like the Trent Green, Priest Holmes, Larry Johnson era, right? I was a gigantic Dante Hall fan. I had a poster of Dante Hall that I got from my very first Chiefs game I ever went to. My grandma took me. We took the bus to Arrowhead. And when we got off the bus, I just thanked the bus driver. I was like 6 or 7 years old. Simple thing. I just thanked the bus driver. And the bus driver stopped me and he gave me this, you know, giant cylindrical container, like this little plastic container, and I open it up and there was a signed Dante Hall poster in it, which I thought was the coolest thing on earth. Ultimately, my younger brother ended up ripping that in half after we got into a fight one day, and I'll never forgive him for it. But I was a giant fan of those Chiefs teams, right? Eddie Kinnison, those were some phenomenal football teams. But they were good, not great, right? They could get to a playoff berth, but they couldn't do anything with it. They could get close to winning the division, but never quite could eclipse what the Chargers were accomplishing in those years, what the Raiders were accomplishing in those years. And then it was a woof. There was a rough stretch there, right? The dark days, as I like to call it, otherwise known as the Todd Haley and Romeo Crennel era of the Kansas City Chiefs, where you had Damon Heward and Matt Castle and Tyler Thigpen and Brody Croyle and Brady Quinn and this revolving door of quarterbacks. And then Big Red shows up and he brings Alex Smith with him. And those teams were good, right? But they weren't great. They got to the playoffs, but they couldn't get there. They couldn't take that next step, right? They would get a big lead against the Indianapolis Colts and then fall apart. They would get a big lead against the Tennessee Titans and fall apart. Enter Patrick LeVon Mahomes II. Enter number 15. When things are grim, be the Grim Reaper, him. And we're sitting here in the midst of a 7-year run that has never been seen before in the history of the National Football League. Just unbelievable. The most wins, most playoff wins by a team in a 7-year stretch in the history of the National Football League. Mahomes is now tied for second all-time in playoff wins by a starting quarterback with Joe Montana at 16. Mind you, Joe Montana played 16 years in the National Football League. Mahomes tied him in 7 seasons. He's made his 7th AFC championship game, putting himself in a tie with just a few others: Steve Young, Joe Montana, and Roger Staubach. those four guys, Mahomes, Young, Montana, and Roger Staubach of the Cowboys, tied for second with the most conference championship appearances in NFL history at 7. The only guy ahead of him in either of those two categories is Tom Brady. That's elite company. Never thought I would see it when I was a kid. You know, my mom's, you know, in her late 40s, she never got to witness a Chiefs Super Bowl, right? I mean, she was not born yet when they won the first Super Bowl with Lynn Dawson, Super Bowl IV. So I can remember in 2020 when they won that first Super Bowl, my mother and my grandma like moved to tears over it. That's how extraordinary that moment was for them. And we can never take for granted where we're at right now. It's unreal. It's absolutely unreal where we're at. And so I got to say, absolutely take that. Don't ever take this for granted. Enjoy every second of this run. Logan Weber here, joined by my producer, Quentin Morris, here on this Sunday morning edition of After Hours after a Chiefs victory. It's a good feeling. This is your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
Tommy Townsend holds it. Fairbairn.
Blocked! It's blocked! The Chiefs blocked the field goal. Picked up on the near sideline and hopping out of bounds with the football is Jaden Hicks.
That's the strongest pound-for-pound player on the Kansas City Chiefs roster. That, according to Andy Reid, Steve Spagnuolo, and other guys within that organization, Leo Chanel picking up his second blocked field goal of the year against two playoff teams. Right, did it against the Broncos earlier in the year in the one matchup where the starters competed. That was, you know, that game week 10, Chiefs win at 16-14, and then he does it again yesterday against the Houston Texans. I think a big factor in that, and we talked about this yesterday on the post game with Chris Unocero, who was producing for me. We talked about that, you know, that was the same side of the field that Kaimi Fairbairn was kicking the 55-yarder on in the first half that he missed well short and well right. Kind of thought, you know, he might have been trying to kick that one at a little bit lower of an angle to try to keep it out of that wind at Arrowhead. And in that moment, Leo Chanel takes full advantage of it. It looked initially like Justin Reed had blocked it. At least that's, you know, the way that Buck and Aikman were talking after the play happened, that it looked like it was Justin Reed, but when you watch the replay, it was Chanel getting a hand on it again as he just continues to make play after play. He's become somewhat of a postseason hero for the Kansas City Chiefs and doing it again in that situation. The Chiefs kind of had the game pretty well in hand already, up 11 at that point, but that was sort of the final proverbial nail in the coffin for the Texans, right? That sort of took any win they had left in their sails completely out of the equation. Of course, you had the Karlaftis sack just before that, you know, CJ Stroud's having to get helped off the field because of an injury. So they were already dealing with a lot there. Their chances were pretty much slim to none. Man, it's a crazy thing. 913-586-7965 is our number. We got a few more messages in the text line talking about records can be broken, but being a Super Bowl champion can never be taken away. Fact. History will remember you for the wins and losses rather than the yards and touchdowns in a lot of different respects. Now, the yards and touchdown passes are great, but Super Bowl wins are an entirely different subject. I got a 913 says, if the Chiefs had replaced the defensive coordinator earlier, we might have two or three more Super Bowl wins. Who's to say he's wrong, right? If they get Steve Spagnuolo in 2016, 2017, who knows? You know, those were some tough years with the Sutton-led Chiefs defenses there because they had talented pieces, right? You had Tamba Hali and Justin Houston and Marcus Peters and Eric Berry and God, they were seemingly still giving up 30 points on a week-by-week basis.
The old Bob Sutton bend but don't break and yet break.
Yeah, Yeah. Bend and break somehow simultaneously.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. Bend themselves 9 yards deep in the end zone, right?
Oh,
that,
my
the
gosh.
Bending didn't start at the 25 or the 30. No, it started at around the 5 yard line and extended itself right across that goal line and into the end zone. Ah, man. Yeah. 913 says we lost our starting number one wide receiver early in the season. Damn right. You lost Rashee Rice with the ACL injury. Hollywood Brown goes down on the first play of the first game of the preseason. What are you supposed to do there? Pacheco goes down early in the year. You've got this revolving door at left tackle, right? That's mentioned in the text line here. We're playing our fourth different player at left tackle. Right, it's a revolving door. You had Wanya Morris. Then you tried Kingsley Suamataia. Didn't quite work out. Then you signed DJ Humphreys. He has a rough game against Denver, and then he goes down with an injury. So you throw Joe Tooney out there. It's been a difficult year in a lot of different aspects. Got a message from a 913 says, I was at the game yesterday. Didn't look ugly to me. Chiefs looked like the better team most of this game. They didn't dominate, but they were better in all aspects. I don't know if I entirely agree with that one. I think that in the first half, the Texans looked like a better football team. They moved the ball more effectively on the offensive side of the football. Their defense looked great, especially their pass rush. They got to Mahomes 3 times in the first half. Didn't get to him in the second half, right? They didn't generate a sack in the second half of that game. But I think in the first half, the Texans certainly, just by appearances, watching the game on television, they looked like they were playing better football, but they were losing, right? That's the thing. If you're playing a better game than the Chiefs and you're still down 7, you don't stand a chance.
I mean, they talked about this on the broadcast multiple times about how, you know, the Chiefs had, at one point, the Chiefs had 40 yards rushing and the Texans had broke 100. At one point, the Chiefs had barely gone over 100 passing yards, and C.J. Stroud had thrown for 150 at that point. Like, they had more first downs. They were able to move the ball, but that's what happens when you miss a kick and you're not able to score touchdowns against Kansas City. How long have we been in this era where it's like you have to score touchdowns against mm-hmm. the Chiefs? And as a Chiefs fan, when I see the Texans settling for field goals, you know, I don't care that the Chiefs are tied at 6-6 now. That's a win for me because I know that I have Patrick Mahomes, and I know that my team at some point is going to score touchdowns. And so as long as the Chiefs can keep it within that one score, especially if that one score is field goals, we got this.
Oh, no doubt. When you're playing a team of the caliber of the Kansas City Chiefs, you got to get 6. You can't settle for 3. Prime example of that, look at what the Washington Commanders did yesterday against the Detroit Lions. Getting 6 instead of 3. Scoring touchdowns instead of settling for field goals. It was a massive factor in the Washington Commanders winning this football game. And they took chances. Give Dan Quinn and that staff for the Washington Commanders a ton of credit. They went for it on 4th down 4 times. They had more 4th down conversion attempts than the Detroit Lions did. To go for it on 4th down more than Dan Campbell is saying something. They converted on 3 of those 4. All 3 of those conversions occurred in the red zone where they had points. They were taking points off the board if you don't convert those. But they knew we have got to score touchdowns if we want to stay with this Detroit Lions team. Detroit turned the ball over 5 times yesterday and still scored 31 points. You know you have to generate touchdowns against teams of that caliber, offenses of that caliber. The Houston Texans just didn't take those chances until it was too late. And then when you decide to go for it on 4th down with 3 timeouts in the 4th quarter of a game where you're down, what do the Texans do? Down 2 scores? Should we punt it? Should we go for it? Should we punt it? Should we go for it? D'Amico Ryans, with about 12 seconds left on the play clock, says, yeah, go ahead, go for it. That's kind of a late decision. They got to scramble to the line. The offense barely has time to get set. The offensive line cannot read what the pressure looks like. C.J. Stroud can't read the secondary and try to decipher and make any audibles. Nothing. And George Karlaftis is able to get a great jump off the ball and generate a sack. That was the difference in these 2 games, right? Yes, turnovers. The Commanders did a great job of turning over Detroit, but the biggest factor in that game was when it came down to it in the biggest moments of the game, Washington refused to settle for field goals when they knew they needed touchdowns. Houston didn't do that. Houston, we've got points. Let's take those points and twice during the course of that game when they thought they had points. They didn't. Missed a field goal wide right on a 55-yarder in a bad spot and then had a block. And then you had the missed field, the missed extra point as well. Rough day for Kyeemy Fairbairn. Rough day. And I had said this, that I thought Kyeemy Fairbairn might be the kicker that struggles more in this matchup. As much conversation as was being made about Harrison Butker, I had faith that Harrison Butker was going to be that guy in the postseason because he has been his entire career. I am of the belief that Harrison Butker belongs in the same sentence as guys like Adam Vinatieri and Steven Gostkowski when it comes to playoff crunch time kicks in the NFL. He is one of those dudes. And he was that dude yesterday. 3 for 3 on kicks. But for Kyeemy Fairbairn, I'm looking at the game and I'm thinking, you know, mid-20s at kickoff, 20-mile-an-hour winds, wind chill in single digits for a guy who grew up in Hawaii, kicked at UCLA, and then was drafted by the Houston Texans. All three warm climate places. Not to mention the Texans have a dome, so he doesn't have to kick in conditions more often than not. Now he's got to go play in Arrowhead Stadium, the most raucous environment in the National Football League, in single-digit weather with 20-mile-an-hour winds. I just didn't think it was a recipe for success for Kyeemy Fairbairn, and that's exactly what happened. They got beat, in special teams especially. That third of the game was a massive factor for the Chiefs. Steve Spagnuolo, a Hall of Famer, I think he should be the first assistant coach to be in the Hall of Fame, put on an absolute defensive masterclass. And Andy Reid outcoached D'Amico Ryans at the head coaching position. No doubt about it. 918 saying the same thing I am. Look at that. Texans got beat by a Hall of Fame coach and a Hall of Fame DC who made adjustments at halftime and a team who is playoff savvy and knows how to turn it on when needed. Exactly. Couldn't have said it any better myself. After hours here on 96.5 The Fan, Logan Weber joined by Quentin Morris. When we come back, we may talk a little bit more about this Chiefs-Ravens game, but I do want to give Quentin some flack because we had college basketball yesterday, and I said I was going to talk about it. He made a joke about my Iowa Hawkeyes, so I've got to get my get back here in just a few. This is After Hours, your home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan. I know that there's a lot to be said because we got football going on. College football playoff national championship tomorrow. Chiefs beat the Texans last night. Commanders beat the Lions. You've got Rams, Eagles, Ravens, Bills today. But there's college basketball going on. And I got to say, I'm a basketball guy. Basketball is my favorite sport, kind of always has been. Played a lot of basketball growing up as a kid. Love watching it. And I love college basketball. I like the NBA too. I know there's a lot of people out there right now making complaints about the NBA. I still love watching the NBA. But college basketball is kind of where I gravitate. Couple of really big performances yesterday for a couple of regional teams. The Kansas Jayhawks. Big in-state rivalry game yesterday. KU, K-State. Jayhawks, the number 9 team in the country, kind of reeling as of late. They suffered a really, really big loss earlier this week against Iowa State in Hilton, right in Ames. But a huge bounce back yesterday for the 9th-ranked Jayhawks, beating K-State 84-74. And as much, you know, attention, probably I would say more negative attention, that guys like Hunter Dickinson and DeJuan Harris have been getting as of late. Man, those guys put up big-time games. Hunter Dickinson, 25 points yesterday, 8 rebounds in the game. Zeke Mayo had 24 in this one. He was 4-of-7 from behind the arc, so a big performance for the young guy there. And then DeJuan Harris, right? He's no more as a facilitator and as a defender. He doesn't score all that much, and you know, some say he can't score. I've got a brother who's a Kansas fan, so I'm constantly having to hear complaints about DeJuan Harris. Well, what does he do yesterday? Puts up 15 on 6-of-9 shooting, 5 rebounds, 5 assists. He had 2 blocks. He only had 1 turnover. Jayhawks shot 55% from the floor. Meanwhile, for Kansas State, their difficult season continues right there. Million-dollar man in Coleman Hawkins, 15 points, 10 assists, 7 rebounds. You know, he almost had a triple-double, but he was 5-of-14 from the field. He was 1-of-7 from behind the arc, so it's not like he had an efficient 15 points last night. Yesterday afternoon, I should say. Wildcats shot less than 46% from the field. They shot 23% from the three-point line, 6 of 26 from behind the arc. It was a rough day if you're a K-State Wildcat fan, and now they're 7-10 on the year. Clinton, your response.
Dickinson scored 25, and if you let a guy who runs like a boxed refrigerator score 25 on you, you know, that's how the season's gone so far.
It's like a walking water heater.
Yeah. The guy, like, that's why he didn't go to the NBA, right? Is because he can't move.
Yeah.
So
I'm not going to argue with that, but yeah, he's got 25-8, put together one of his best performances of the year for a guy who seemingly kind of regressed after past seasons. But then the other one, hey folks, the Mizzou Tigers are for real. I know that's going to make Carrington Harrison very happy, but this Mizzou team is the real deal. They play Arkansas yesterday, John Calipari's Razorbacks. They win it 83-65. They were up 17 at halftime. They scored 52 points in the first half. Mizzou got off to a hot start and just rode that to the finish line. Mark Mitchell had 17. Tamar Bates finished with 15. Caleb Grill off the bench has become one of the best sixth men in college basketball this year, alongside, you know, that guard for Iowa State who's averaging like 17 a game off the bench. He scored 17 on 7 of 10 shooting. He was 3 of 5 from the three-point line. He also had 4 steals, 5 rebounds, and 3 assists in this game. Trent Pierce was an efficient 4 of 4. He scored 10 points. Mizzou's 15-3. They're 4-1 in the SEC right now. For a team that did not win an SEC game last year, they're now 4-1. Latest bracketology, Joe Lenardi has Mizzou as an 8 seed. I think this is a Mizzou team that's talented enough to be a 4 or a 5. I really believe that. I think this is a Mizzou team that could win 22 or 23 games, finish with 13, 14 wins in the SEC, and put themselves in a position to be the higher seeded team. Okay. All right. Where's Kansas State going to be at this March? Just curious to get your thoughts on that, Quinn. You think they're going to be in Manhattan watching the NCAA tournament?
I think the show's over.
Is it? Yeah, it is. All right. This edition of After Hours on this Sunday has come to a close. For Logan Weber, my producer, Quentin Morris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate you calling in and sending messages on the text line. Always good to have a conversation on a victory Sunday following a Chiefs win. We'll wait with bated breath to see who the Chiefs play next week in the AFC Championship game. You're listening to the home for Kansas City sports, 96.5 The Fan.
On the Powers That Be podcast, we examine the players and currents behind today's most consequential decisions. Join us. Listen to the Powers That Be wherever you get your podcasts.